Welcome back to the Mawa Dissing Show. I'm Shirley Nordrum.
I'm Sharon Nordrum.
And today we're up at the Watermark Art Center visiting with Karen Goulet and Carl, an artist in residency. And so I'm going to let Karen introduce Carl and how he got here, and then we'll hear Carl's story.
Well, Carl is, we adopted each other
four years ago
when he was in Montana as a Fulbright scholar at the Salish Kootenai College and Flathead Valley Community College, and he and his family were there for 10 months. So he came in and he instructed in about Maori culture and Maori art, and also take courses. It was about a culture exchange for him. So as part of that, in the spring, I said, you guys have to go back and meet my people, meet our community. And so I sent him back during Big Drum ceremony, and he was out at White Earth, and they did presentations at BSU, and very well received and very well remembered, and people kept asking when they were going to come back again. And I think Ruya had decided that you hadn't done enough work in his art, so she wrote a grant for him to come back for, it was 2 years ago, I believe, for an artist in residence. So we did a tour de force of Washington State out to here, and so he spent some time in our community here again doing his work and learned some techniques like the sweetgrass basket you saw out there. Carl's a wonderful artist, a wonderful diplomat, a wonderful friend, and I was real happy. He contacted me at the time we were starting to get things going with the Mekonon Gallery, and it was very good time. He said, I'm looking at pursuing a grant. Do you have anything you might want to, any opportunities? He's like, oh, do we have opportunities? So he wrote the proposal and received the grant, and part of that is to come here and be an artist in residence. Welcome back.
It's good to be back.
It's a pleasure to meet you.
Thank you. As Karen mentioned, we met in Montana in 2010 through to 2014. As far as Karen was concerned, when I first met her, you know, if I hadn't seen the Anishinaabe, I hadn't seen anything. It's the center of the universe. She always raved about White Earth, Red Lake, Bemidji, this region, and she said if there was any place that I had to visit, it had to be here.
I agree.
You know, when you're out in Montana, but Montana is quite a distance from here, and that's a little bit of a drive.
A little bit.
Well worth it.
But it was well worth it. So when she first initiated our visit here, I think we did a crazy drive from Montana itself right across to as far as Madison, going through different reservations and meeting the different people that she suggested that we meet, or she said, you must go here. and that's how we started a lot of the relationships. Then came back following year because, as she mentioned, my wife felt that I hadn't quite progressed my art. I hadn't quite met all the people that I needed to meet. And it was also to secure all the relationships that we'd built up.
Right.
Otherwise, you know, you just meet a person once, it sort of falls apart. So
you've
just got to maintain coming back all the time.
You do.
And Karen became very good family to us. Her house was our second house, especially when we were in Montana. And we've maintained that contact since then. As Māori, it's important for us as a people to maintain relationships.
Mm-hmm.
It's not networking. Networking is not something we really do. It's about building up relationships or family.
Right.
And so that's the important thing about coming back this time around. But yes, my wife again felt that my art had gone a little bit stale and stagnant, and she said, you need to get out there again. And while you're there, you must do this. And so she's saying to me, now I have to look at fashion. Yeah, we'll see about that.
Well, we were just out in the gallery looking at some of your art, and it's beautiful. It really can't be described, I don't think, on the radio unless you can describe your art somehow. But it's a fiber art, and you want to tell us about that as best you can? I mean, it's hard because it's so beautiful, you just got to come into the gallery and see it. But
yes, no description by word can really describe what you see by sight. When you say fiber, well, fiber is something that you've actually not only got to see, you've got to feel it as well.
Right.
Primarily, I work with a plant we call New Zealand flax. It was a godsend to my people when we arrived in New Zealand, because we're Polynesian. And when we came from the islands, we arrived in New Zealand, which was uninhabited. And at that time, the major plant there was this leaf. And so we extract, we use the leaf in all sorts of senses, because we can use it to weave baskets. We extract fiber for clothing, ropes. You can use it for fishing nets. You can even use it as a medicine. So it's a multi-purpose plant. The interesting thing about the plant itself is that it has many sides to it. If you leave the leaf, it'll roll and curl into a cylinder, so it looks like it's reeds. If you extract the fiber, you can have both at the same time, both a reed appearance and fiber appearance, and then you can just extract the fiber entirely and just spin that and make your clothing out of that. So the pieces that we have here are a combination of that.
Yeah, because I was thinking it was a reed, and then I went, that's being wove. How does that work? You couldn't do that with any of our type of reeds that I know of.
No, I think dog's bane was one, and I think Montana, most things that I've found here are very difficult to extract. So I think one of my ancestors had said it to an Englishman, how did you survive? Because, you know, we have flax, and, you know, it really is a godsend.
We survived quite well, thank you.
You know,
we learned to use what we have.
Yes. But for what I've observed, you know, it's quite a rigorous process for a lot of your dyes. A lot of the processes of weaving are quite methodical, but quite lengthy.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas we can just take this plant and work with it straight away. And, you know, the fiber itself, once it's extracted, is very silky. Even in its core state, it's still pleasant enough that you can have it directly against your skin. So, yeah, we were really lucky. We hit the jackpot when we hit Aotearoa, New Zealand.
So the pieces that we were looking at, there are a lot of, like, mocha browns and tans, but there's this brilliant gold color. And, you know, the fact that you're using natural dyes, I'm kind of fascinated by dyes and natural dyes. You know, I may not get into the art part of it, but how you get the dye is, like, really fascinating to me. So that brilliant gold, what is that plant?
The brilliant gold is a bark dye. We can collect it year-round, but, you know, depending on the season when you get it, will dictate its sort of color. It can go anywhere from an old gold look to a very almost fluorescent yellow. Sometimes, if you, it's heat reactive, so in the dyeing process, if you heat dry it too quickly, it'll turn a vibrant pink.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's
how does that happen?
You know, sometimes you don't want pink, so you've actually got to go through the process again and let it dry and cool naturally, otherwise it's a very vibrant pink. Most of the dyes that we do use are quite natural because it's all vegetation.
Right.
And the prime reason that I use a lot of natural dyes is to keep the methods going. You know, you can always learn how to do things, but it's a little bit like your mother's, grandmother's fried bread or bread. Mm-hmm. You know the basic steps, but sometimes it's just those little tiny tips that they use that you'll lose. So it's about keeping those processes still relevant today, as long as we can use them.
Right.
You know, there may become a time where you can't access these dyes and plants. So while they're still here, while they're still available, I'll continue to use them.
We'll always be able to.
Yes, well, that's what I think.
That's the fear. I mean, that's how, you know, we're just in the final stages of making the sugar, you know, and the people I sugar with, we keep it as old style as possible. I mean, and to know everything that's going on, I guess I didn't realize how much we knew after, you know, 20, 26, 28, 30 years of sugaring, but other people come in and they're like, they don't know what to do. And it's those processes, those little tiny steps that when you do it, you don't think much about it, but they're critical in having a good outcome.
That's right. It's all about the quality in the end. Yeah. Without those tiny little steps, there's a step missing in the outcome towards the quality of it.
And the funny things, like finding out that it turns bright pink. I mean, yeah. you don't do that unless you're actually doing it yourself, and it may be a mistake. You just like waited a little too long.
Well, it was a little bit of a mistake. I was training a student at the time, and because we were dealing with the yellow, and she asked, "Well, how can I dry this?" I said, "Just put it in front of the fan heater." Then it turned to brilliant pink, and she was horrified because it wasn't the colour she wanted. No, I was excited by the colour because you don't get that colour very often. But pink wasn't what she was wanting. She wanted gold.
She just wasn't flexible enough.
She wasn't flexible enough.
You should have told her, remember a sunrise. There's pink in a sunrise along with the gold.
Yeah. No, it doesn't quite work with her. So, there's golds, there's browns, which are just the usual bark dyes. There's black. Our black is a swamp mud. So we actually have to go out to the swamp to collect this mud. It's been decomposing for some time.
Right.
It's silky to the touch. Smells a little. Yeah. But in order to get the black, you've also got to pre-dye it in a bark dye as well, because the bark fixes it.
Okay.
It's a mordant, a tannin.
Right.
The tree dyes are tannins or mordants. They fix the black. Without it, it just goes gray.
Oh, so the mud, do you mix that mud in with some water to make a dye? Or do you lay
have to lay the fiber and the leaf into the mud.
Okay.
So you've got to totally submerge it. But prior to that, you've got to submerge it into the mordant, the tannin dye, so that it'll soak in. And each tannin dye itself has a different, gives a different result of black. You can go anywhere from a charcoal black to a deep, dark, dull black to a almost a blue black.
Wow.
Just depending on which tree you use as your mordant.
Wow. For fun.
You want to go to New Zealand now, don't you?
I don't know whether you'd find it fun, especially when you've got to go in the mud. But
that part doesn't bother me.
But if you like your hands nice and clean, this is not the job for you.
No, I don't. Because all they're clean right now.
You can imagine if you go to the store or something, your hands are usually black, your fingernails are dirty, and it looks like you haven't washed a bit. you could have scrubbed your hands down, but it stays like that for at least 3 days. It ingrains into the skin.
I just had that this last week. We were dyeing, making black ash baskets, and I was dyeing with Rit dye.
Yes.
But yes, I was walking around with purple hands for a couple of days.
Yeah.
And it's, I thought it was cool. So
if you want soft, silky hands, this is not for you.
I always think dirty hands, stained hands are signs of hands of people that work, and I get a lot of, I think some people think, you should try to wash that off. But I always think that's a badge of honor because it means you're doing something.
Yes, yep. It is. We have an old saying, moia te tangata ringaropa, which means marry the person with callous hands.
Yep.
Because you always know you're going to get fed. In other words, they're industrious, they're hardworking. Yeah.
Yeah.
The hands say it all.
They do.
They certainly do. So I have heard a lot about the Mori, about language revitalization and not so much the art parts of that. So I'm guessing that you're a fluent speaker of your own language.
My wife would say, yes, you are. I'd say, no, I'm competent.
Competent, yeah.
When we came across the last time, all my children speak Māori. And so whenever we were somewhere that they weren't familiar with or we wanted to talk to them without anyone really knowing what we were saying, then we'll talk in our language. I think at the time we were probably doing 60% Māori with them and probably 40% English. As children get older, though, it gets a little bit harder. Mm-hmm. Your patience is a little bit shorter. And so now it's kind of switched where we're probably 40% Māori, 60% English. But an interesting observation of a friend of ours down in Missoula, and he's a language teacher there. One thing he did notice with our children at the time, because they were from 6 years old to 11 or 12 at the time, they're now, the oldest is 16, youngest is 11. But when they were stressed, they'd speak in our language. And he said that's a good sign of how ingrained a language is that when you're in your most stress mode, the first language you react or speak in tells you where their language is at or their mindset is at. It's really hard to be a language dragon with your children because, you always tell them, speak in your language, speak in your language. But I think an important thing of our elders of the time was it's important to speak well in whatever language you speak in True. Regardless of whether English or Māori, speak well. And a lot of my aunts and uncles were like that. They wouldn't, you know, they were basically like old English school moms. You had to speak properly. You weren't allowed to say yous. It was always you. And you'd be corrected in front of anyone. So they were quite particular on how they spoke, regardless of English or Māori.
That's interesting because, like, the concept of yous is something that we have in Ojibwe. So when someone says yous, you kind of just know what they're talking about. And people say it all the time.
I know. How are yous?
Yeah, no one's correcting the English piece of it.
My aunt used to say, you is a plural word. There is no such word as yous unless you're sheep. Oh, they were dragons. Yeah. I'm sure you had your dragons. We have our dragons as well. And, you know, they were matriarchs and patriarchs, and you didn't mess with them. Their word was law. But you
tell
know.
Your grandma's story. I want the grandma's story when you were being cheeky.
Oh,
or do you want to share that one on radio?
Oh, no, that's fine. My grandmother lived with us till she was 105. She was 92 when I was born.
Wow.
She was my best friend, my worst enemy. As you are with, you know, a grandchild and a grandparent. She'd sometimes favour me over my siblings. And, you know, she'd say things like, "Oh, haere koe ki te tō ki te hokorere mai tāua," which means, grandchild, go to the shop and buy some lollies. So, you know, you could make the others a little bit more jealous. But this one time I teased her a bit too much. And of course she was 97 and she wasn't that fast moving, and I was quick, of course. I escaped outside. She had a long memory, I didn't. And I just happened to walk back inside the house into the lounge, and she was standing to the side of the door in the lounge. As I stepped inside, she quickly reached down, grabbed me by one leg, lifted me up with one hand, and smacked me with the other. She held me off the ground. She was 97 years old. You can imagine her strength when she was in her prime.
I
put in my grandfather, I think she was pretty fearsome. I've heard stories about from my father about her picking another person up by the shoulders. She stood about 6 foot, close to 6 foot.
Oh, wow. She's
about
tall.
5'11", 6. But she was tough. She chopped firewood right up until she was 106.
Holy smokes.
When she turned about 105, 106, she went to live with an aunt. And my aunt at that time was in her 80s, I think. 70, 80s. You know, there's a 70-year-old looking after a 100-year-old. And so they used to hide the axe from her because she'd go looking for the axe to go and chop firewood. But she lived to 112. She passed away by accident. I know, it's funny, but it's not funny. She was in hospital at the time having a checkup and staying there for a little bit. And this one time she happened to go and shower, slipped in the shower, broke her hip, and that was basically the end.
That happens to a lot of elders. You know, break
the hips. Hard to recover and heal from that. You know, she had her marbles right up to the very bitter end, so she would sing traditional songs. Her long-term memory was great, her short-term memory not so great.
As was most of us.
And she smoked to the bitter end. she's, and that's why you'll see the printout there has her with a pipe in her mouth.
Yeah.
So, you know, as she got older, she went from growing her own tobacco, using a pipe, to smoking cigarettes. I think the funniest thing was when she was being cared for in the hospital at that time, because they used to still allow smoking, is that the nurses would get a bit concerned because sometimes they'd go past her bed and there'd be a blanket over her and they'd see a little red light underneath it. She would be having a sneaky puff. So she was a bit of a fire risk. But she was very sharp to the end. She never forgot, you know, I still remember her even saying to me, she was complaining, and I said to the nurse, "She's asking where her money is." And the nurse said, "No, there was no money." And then she says, "Kairaruita ko panikuti." And I said, "She's just told me that it's underneath her skirt, you know, those old lady skirt apron, sacking sort of looking material. She's pinned it underneath there." And sure enough, there was $100 pinned underneath. And that was 1984.
Oh,
so,
wow.
You know, $100 in 1984 was pretty big money. So, you know, if you remember where your money is at 112, you know, that's pretty good going.
Yeah, I'd say.
So, you know, she was sharp to the end. But she wove right to up until she was 100. My third basket that I made, I just happened to be, you know, take it with me at the time. And then, of course, she says, oh, my God, which means pass it over here. Let me have a look at it. And, of course, she looks inside, outside, up and down. And then, you know, her final comment was, he ata hua engare he ririki I kone, kare ro kawhati, which means, it's beautiful, but it's too fine over here and it won't be long before it breaks. I was thinking, at 112. You know, still critiquing.
Yeah.
So, you know, and I still had that basket. It's nice. And she was right, because
I
the areas,
you,
the areas
she, right?
she pointed at are the very first areas that frayed.
Really?
And so I keep that. It's a good memory.
Yes, it is. Is she the one that taught you then how to weave, or did you pick that up somewhere else and just have her critique?
Well, as I was growing up, I learned a little bit of weaving from her, and they were simple plaits. You know, first of all was a three plait, how to spin fibre, and then there's actual a leaf plait that we use, and we use it for headbands. So that was a sort of weaving. She taught me how to play cards. She taught me how to cheat. But they were simple things. So her and my aunties, they would often mix sometimes traditional techniques with craft techniques, you know, just to see how it would come out. And I had weaving all along the way, but it wasn't something that you did a lot of. I mean, you did a little. It probably wasn't until I reached my teens and I started working in a tourism area that with women who were in their 50s and 60s, and they knew my grandmother. You know, Māori is to us as a people, it's more when they meet you, it's, so who are you? I don't want to know about you. Who are you? Who are your people?
Yes.
I want to know, you know, your family. And because when you mention a name, they go, oh, yes, oh, good family. Or no, bad family. So, no, we weren't one of those families. So they knew my grandmother. They knew my aunts. And they knew they were all weavers. And they liked them. They knew my uncle. He was the first director of the centre that I was working at the time. I didn't know that. Well, I was only a teenager, you know, you don't really worry about your parents and grandparents and what they did.
No.
And my sister had also married into their clan. And I mean, you know, it's as different as Red Lake and White Earth. You know, you might be Ojibwe, but, you know, they're over there, you're over there. And then when you get into particulars, it's what side of the lake you're from.
Oh.
So, you know, I must have been okay, because they either liked my, they must have liked my poisonality. And so the good thing about these women is each woman, they were all weavers, and they sometimes had their own little technique. Each person has their own special thing. And so sometimes they'd say to me, haramai, noho mai I kone, which means, come and sit over here. And then they'd say, as we were doing some form of weaving, they say, you see what she's doing over there? Don't do it like that, do it like this. Because this is better. So what I was lucky, why I was lucky was I was able to glean their techniques and the best of their techniques. And then, of course, the final statement from most of them was, but don't you show anyone else. If you do, I'll know it's you and I will come and see you. You know, always with a pointed and raised finger, that was their habit. So, you know, because I think part of it was keeping your work better or different than someone else's. You know, I think artists are all like that. While we like to share, you also are competitive.
Right.
And it's about making my piece a little bit better than yours. So
distinct, yeah.
Very mean. Distinct.
Yeah.
And so I was lucky in that manner that I got to learn off a lot of good weavers, actually all sorts of people. Whether they be language practitioners, spiritual practitioners, weaving practitioners, and most of them were all elderly, because my parents were elderly, so I grew up around a lot of older people and not like those of my generation. So, I was fortunate to be around a lot of them.
You were lucky.
Yeah, and I thought that was the norm. to me that was normal, you know, having weaving and carving, because that's what I saw when I was growing up. I thought, yeah, everyone has them. You know, it's only a bit of weaving. What's in, and a lot of our people turn and say, you're just so lucky. And I'm thinking, no, we consider it normal.
Oh, yeah.
You know, you don't, when you're in it, you don't see it as luck. You see it as, that's the normal part of life.
But then once you grow up and get out there, you realize how lucky you
are. Then you're lucky, yes.
Yes.
You know, people see me training my children, but they've said to me, so will you train your children? Will they have the choice? I said, there is no choice. They will work whether they like it or not. They will be doing this work. And so, you know, if you ask my children about weaving with the fibre, they're only doing some, you know, they're doing the donkey's work, we call it. And that's some of the harder work. As far as they're concerned, they're not as lucky as their friends.
Yeah.
But they don't realise that what it's teaching them is good work ethic, mythology, as you know, that there's a method and process to reach certain outcomes. So it's those things that we got taught that, you know, that you don't realise that you are being taught. So I think it puts them in a good stead for when they get older. They may not take up weaving, but at least they'll take the processes and the methods with them.
That's how I feel about my parents. They were berry pickers, so I mean, when you're a kid picking berries and there's mosquitoes and flies and it's hot, you know, you don't necessarily think about that as being lucky, but I know so much about the woods compared to other people that, you know, other people will call and say, can you get me and name some plant? And I'm like, yeah, can't you go get it yourself? I don't know what I'm looking for, you know. So that closeness with the nature is as a gift from them that came from berry picking, which at the time I thought was hot and sticky and buggy. And why do we do this? So when I hear similarities between Anishinaabe culture and what you're saying. So how do you feel about, you know, because you're hanging out with Shinobs and you're here, so do you see the similarities or is it just...
There are actually a lot of similarities between our people and practices. That's initially why our family more or less hung out with any Indians, because we felt at home.
Yeah.
The community we were in was primarily a white community, and you know, we were kind of an oddity there, and no one likes to be odd. We want to go where we blend in.
Yeah.
So the best blending place was amongst us Indians on reservations. So, you know, when we were extended an invitation, we'd go. But the practices are very similar. I'd just say that sometimes you guys are a bit more extreme than us, just that little bit more extreme. You know,
in what way?
I don't know. It's
the weather.
It's like the weather. We're kind of the middle of the road people, you know, but it's from 0 to 100 here. You're like that way or that way. But with us, I'd say we're kind of more mid ground.
That's interesting. Maybe it is the weather.
Yeah.
I mean, we do definitely live within the extremes.
Yeah.
It's either this way or that way.
Yeah. It's the weather, I think. The environment creates how people are. And, you know, in New Zealand, we're sort of just middle sort of weather. We're kind of the middle of everything. You know, where I live, we're in the middle of only an hour from the beach. But we consider ourselves interior.
Oh, okay.
You know, nothing like here. I mean, New Zealand, you could probably travel across our country width-wise in 5 hours. Length-wise, about, say, 20.
Haven't even left the state here.
Yeah, well, exactly. So to us, 45 minutes inland from the sea is inland. So I'm an interior lake person, you see. And you think, what? That's only an hour's drive from the sea, but we're also an hour from snow, so everything is quite contained and condensed in New Zealand. So you could travel within a few hours and find the landscape changes. Whereas here, you travel for miles. So that's what I mean by 0 to 100. It's quite extreme and it's quite vast.
Yeah.
Whereas we're compact and,
Very cool. I don't know much about New Zealand, actually. I'm
horrible. Do you know where it's at?
Actually, no, I don't.
We're just a little bit further south than Australia. We are not Australian.
At least I had you around the right continent. So,
think of it, we're the most southern natives.
Okay.
We're southern natives.
Yes.
So of the Polynesians, we're the most southern. Our Hawaiian cousins are the most northern.
Oh, okay.
So same people, but we're southerners.
In case you didn't pick up on it, I'm a bit geographically challenged. You don't want me to get a geography question if we're playing Trivial Pursuit, because that team will lose.
But, you know, we've got a good country. There's very little, hardly anything that's actually poisonous there. They're all introduced now.
Yeah.
Otherwise, we only had one poisonous spider, and it only bites you if you sat on it.
Well, there you go.
But that was it. So, you know, nothing really dangerous over there. You won't get attacked by anything in the bush.
There, now we're all going to move there.
It's a very safe place.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, we have a lot of tick disease around here anymore.
No ticks really.
Really kind of killing us, actually.
I know, good. I heard about the Lyme disease, and of course I'm horrified about going to the bush because...
They're out.
Yeah.
I just heard yesterday to put peppermint. If you put like peppermint on your shoes, peppermint oils, the ticks will stay away. They don't like it.
I'm gonna douse myself in that stuff. I've already have the disease, but I mean it can be degenerative, you know. So you don't need to get it again.
So I was really interested in that. I was like, wow, really?
So try the peppermint oil.
Put peppermint on.
Well, good. I have some. I think.
Well, I mean, you know, if that is an old wives' tale, at least you'll smell good.
Yeah, that's right. And be calm.
No, it's a company is putting out. It's a tick. And it's peppermint oil, and they have something else in there, but it was basically peppermint oil.
So you're here for a month.
Yes.
And then do you have any other places that you're going in the near future?
So once the month is up, I probably have about 2 more weeks, and I'm going to fly do a fly through Montana and Washington to catch up with all the families that I've been
right.
wise over there. You know, it's important. Since I'm in the Northern Hemisphere,
right?
And you know, sometimes people spot you on Facebook, and I heard you are coming. You are coming to visit. And it's sort of like, how do you say to a person? And when they say you're coming to visit, aren't you?
Yeah.
Then it's just yes.
Yes.
Yes, I'm coming. Yes. So I'm going as far as Near Bay, which is the northern tip of Washington State. Mm-hmm. So
nice. And your whole family's with you?
No, it's just me.
Just you?
But in saying that, this is the second time I've come back across without them. There were large protests the first time I came back without them. And the last one, my daughter said to me, "You're not going across again without us. We are all coming with you next time." Yes. And I said, well, actually, that's good. And so what I said to my daughter is, then, if that's going to be the case, you have to learn how to dance, and you will perform. And you will weave.
Yeah.
And she said, yes, I'll do that.
Okay.
Said, well, because you're not going to be just, you know, sitting on the side smiling while Dad does all, you know. You will be engaged just like I will be.
So how many children do you have?
Four. Four too many. Originally we were going for 6, but we got to 4, and my wife said, I don't think I can do any more. Stop at 4 and you can name her. And I said, no, it's a boy. She says, no, it's a girl. I said, no, it's a boy. She goes, I know it's a girl. I said, no, I know it's a boy. And I won.
And that little spirit was inside going, oh. Who am I?
I know. But, you know, even in that sense, I've always known when she was pregnant. You know, she'd have no idea. And then I'd say, as soon as I was certain, and, you know, you hear and you get your confirmation, that I'd tell her. She goes, are you sure? So yes, best bets are on me.
You're wearing a beautiful stone necklace. Did you make that yourself? Or?
No, it's what we call a heitiki, or tiki for short. It was made by my cousin when he first started learning carving, and as part of when they were learning back in the 80s, they had to carve jade as well. So it's greenstone, or we call it greenstone. Everybody else calls it jade. The symbol tiki is part of our creation story, and it symbolizes an embryo. It's the first growth of human life. So that's quite often when you look at it, you can see the head's tilted sideways. Because like a baby, you know, the weakest part is the head, so it tilts from side to side. Besides the symbolism of it, we usually name it after an event or an ancestor. So the idea is that you hand it down through the generations from the older son to the, from the father to the older son, or mother to the oldest daughter. Sometimes it bypasses that if you think the oldest isn't the best, but that's not always the case.
That happens here too.
That sometimes bypasses. But so you wear not only the persons that it's named after, you wear everybody else who's worn it as well. Because, you know, your body oils go into the stone. So it kind of picks up people's, you know, your ancestors' energy along the way. And it itself can have its own little poisonality.
Yeah.
And I mean that too.
It's absolutely beautiful. And that patina on there is part of what makes it.
Yeah.
It's all your ancestral oils on there.
It's all the oils. Well, my grandmother's one was about 400 years old. It's now held by a niece of mine, as in my first cousin's daughter now holds it, and she's in her 70s.
Wow.
So, you know, it goes to the oldest daughter.
Uh-huh.
But I remember wondering, you know, my grandmother, if she'd take it off, she'd get really panicky. And then my mother told me that when she was young, she got her tiki when she was 2 weeks old. Her mother passed away not long after she was born. And then she was swimming in the river one day at the age of 8. And she lost it. And then she went swimming in the same place at the age of 12 and it came back.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, those sort of stories you think, ooh, yeah, those are spooky stuff.
That's cool stuff.
Yeah. But because of that, whenever she went near water, she was always concerned that it just might swim away.
Yeah.
So, you know, she'd put it to the side. And we'd always get, if she couldn't find it, we got accused, of course, of stealing it. But,
playing a trick on her.
I'm kind of thinking that's one of those things that you don't touch. You know,
we have lots of those things that you look at and you think, ooh, no, I don't want to touch that.
Yeah. Especially other people's things. That's what I was taught when growing up, like regalia and things like that. You didn't not touch someone else's stuff. And the thought to steal someone else's stuff was like absolutely, like when I heard of people stealing beadwork, and I'm like, are they crazy? You know, there's something going to happen to them.
Yeah. We have exactly the same belief, you know, because it does happen. Even traditionally, I think, you know, there'd always be that one person to go and do that sort of behavior. But you always think, oh, I think that's going to come back and bite you in the butt.
Yeah, it will.
You're going to be sorry. But, you know, and sometimes it just didn't affect that person. It affected generations to follow.
Mm.
So, you know, and that's when they talk about, which family is that person? Oh, that family. Don't marry into their family because of this.
Yeah.
And in their great-great-great-grandparents' time, this is what happened here. And that's why they had that trait. So don't you marry them. Stay away from their family.
Well, I'm glad we're not that strict here because my brothers are real. So is that a stone that's in New Zealand, the jade, is it there? Because you said you come from someone else, place else to New Zealand.
Yeah, we've been, as a people, we've been in New Zealand for over 1,200 years.
Oh, okay. Wow, that's a long time.
So, you know, they're Polynesian, but when they got south and they finally stayed there and didn't go back to the islands. I'm kind of disappointed because I think tropical weather would have been really nice. But the stone itself comes from our South Island. So we have a North and South Island. And it only comes from one section. And that's where they found it, was in the South Island, New Zealand. So a lot of our clans would trade with the southern tribes for the jade.
It's absolutely beautiful. And the earrings, you have a white, one's white and a little looking.
Well,
what is that kind of stone is that?
Well, that stone is very rare. It's come from a shop. You know, one of those shops.
Okay.
Well. I think the black might be. No, I'm just not sure what kind of composite it is. I used to wear shark's teeth.
Oh, okay.
As in thread the cords through my ears. But that's when I first met my wife, and then we had children. And when you have cords in your ears, your children tug on them. So, so I stopped wearing the traditional earrings and just wore these because they went through the holes.
Right. Yeah, I met a Maori woman a long time ago, back when I was going to BSU. I was taking some kind of indigenous law course, and she came, visited us, and really all I remember was the thing she had on around her neck. And it had one of the, like, part of it was the same circular design that's in your earring. That's why I'm very fascinated by what you have on. It's like, that was so beautiful. It was.
I could have made a nice story about it, and I thought about it.
Well, that's it, you know.
But, you know, the other thing about wearing these pendants is it's like a shield, because you just don't know the people you're around. I mean, I'm not talking about people here. One is its identity. But in our own gatherings, our own Māori gatherings, you know, sometimes people give you the eye. So, you know, the idea is that hopefully it'll absorb that energy and stop it from hitting you. So for a lot of our gatherings, that's why we wear them.
A lot of the same things, like copper for us is something that...
You know, to deflect.
Cedar, yeah.
To deflect.
Those things protect you because you don't know who you're around. Yeah.
Well, it'll lighten the blow of the hatchets that you're going to get in your back. So, yeah, we're no different. You know, except these days, I don't think a lot of people know that sort of behaviour, although, you know, sometimes an unintentional thought is still a thought.
Yes, it is.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not as deadly as they used to be, but you know, a mosquito bite is still a bite.
Yes, it is. Well, that's beautiful stories you shared with us today. And I really thank you for taking the time to sit down and share the stories with all the people that are going to hear it.
Kia ora. Kia ora means you're welcome. It's our all multi-purpose word. It means good health to you, you know, life to you. So it's used as a hello, a goodbye, a thank you. It's our all go-to word.
Yeah. We use miigwech, and sometimes we use that word in ways when we shouldn't, because the deeper meaning to that is, like, it's so much what you gave us. And today it is. It's so much that you shared the story of your people and your family and your craft with us. So, truly, miigwech.
Thank you.
What? This program has been funded by the Legacy Arts, Culture, and Heritage Fund of Minnesota.